This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington, catching up with Marty O'Donnell. It's so much fun to have a chance to talk with you again.
It feels like it's been a long time. This pandemic has kept me all closed up, so I'm glad to talk to you, Kate.
Oh, yeah. It's fun, and I'm really looking forward to talking with you about the soundtracks for Myth, The Fallen Lords, and Myth 2, Soul Blighter. And I know originally the only way to get these soundtracks was if you had the original CD-ROMs, right?
Bungie, back when, and this was, when I started working on Myth, it was before I was even part of Bungie. I was a freelancer. And right away we said, hey, you know, should we release these on CD? So you could actually order them from Bungie just as a standalone CD to listen to. You didn't need to get the CD-ROM. So you could buy the CDs, and that's why there was only a limited run of them, because a few years after we started doing it, we were bought by Microsoft and Bungie stopped making products. And I guess O'Donnell Salvatore probably technically could have picked up the mantle of making and distributing CDs, but that's not the business we were in, so we didn't either. And whatever the initial run of CDs that there were, ended up becoming sort of extra valuable.
Sure.
And collector's items, which is one of the reasons why I decided to re-release them, because I thought, oh, people should at least be able to get the high-res versions and listen to them without having to pay a lot of money. That's ridiculous. So
yeah. So now they're on Bandcamp, and anybody can go to your Bandcamp page and grab them. And honest to gosh, you know, it's, people say all the time that it's just like the years fall away when you listen to a soundtrack that has like a whole lot of meaning, and same. And so what was it like for you? I'm sure you remember them, but when you put them on Bandcamp, did you like revisit them and listen to them and say, hey, yeah, you know, that was really some pretty good stuff?
You know, the funny thing is, I put them on Bandcamp, just technically dragged them and stuck them up there. And then I looked for a couple, I put some bonus PDFs of scores or pictures, or so I put some sort of bonus items on it. So if you want to get the thing from Bandcamp, I mean, you could listen to it for free on Bandcamp. But if you want to download them, you get some extra bonus stuff. So that was cool. But no, I didn't actually, I listened to see if the beginnings were, you know, working. But I didn't listen to the whole thing. But I knew I was going to be talking to you last night, so I started listening to Myth 1 again. And it did bring back a lot of memories. And, you know, they're happy memories. These are nice pieces. I mean, some of these I'm like, oh, that was kind of cool. I like that. So it was fun to hear again just last night, actually. So
yeah. And I've been listening to them. It's cool that they follow, you know, the story arc for each of, you know, Myth and then Myth 2. And
yeah,
the way that you got connected with Bungie, I think, really speaks to kind of the way things were in the mid to late 90s. You just, I don't know, got in touch and said, hey, can I write music for you guys? But how did they get on your radar in the first place?
I initially, in 1993, I enjoyed playing games. And a friend of mine who had a radio talk show in Chicago, his name is Dick Staub, said that his 18-year-old son was coming over and he's interested in music and artistic stuff, and he would love to see my studio. Mike and I had a studio in Chicago. So I had Josh, his son, come down to the studio. He looked at all of our cool equipment, and you know, I was showing him stuff, and he saw that over on the shelf, I had a few computer games in boxes. And he said to me, oh, I have friends who make computer games. And I remember thinking, well, that's cute. He's 18. He's got some friends in Spokane, Washington, that make computer games. I'm doing air quotes. Uh-huh. I really just thought, how, you know, what could that be? And he says, well, I have a beta version of a game. I'd love to show it to you. I know this is a long story, but bear with me on this. So he came over to my house that night and had a beta version of this new game and stuck it in my CD-ROM, which I had in my home studio. And up came Myst, you know, it will become your world myth. And I was just blown away immediately. It took him a second. He had to call Rand Miller, believe it or not, to get it to work on my machine. But something about HyperCard. There was something about having to enable color HyperCard. It was really funny. Anyway, I have no idea what I've learned since then, that it was kind of an unusual thing. But anyway, I played that all night, told him I needed to meet his friends because I thought this is the big step forward for video games that I've been waiting for, where it's beautiful art, interesting story, actual physical human beings acting and voice, doing voice work, and music that was cinematic rather than level music. So I thought, I have to get in on this. And I thought, it's too late, I'll never get in on it. And it, basically, it took me 3 years of cajoling to actually get in on it. And I did, I got the gig for us to work on Riven, which was the sequel to Myst. So by 96, I'm visiting Spokane and talking to the guys at Cyan Interactive, the makers of Myst and of course Riven. But while I was there, now I'm finally to the point, while I was there, they would break every day, like at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a literal alarm would go off in their studio and they would break and they would start playing this multiplayer game. And they were totally addicted to it. Each one of these guys on their own machine, shooting other people on the other machines. And I'm like, what? I'm standing there. I'm like, what game is this? And they said, it's called Marathon. It's the coolest thing ever. So I sort of stuck that in the back of my head, went back to Chicago. And I found out very quickly through a chat room that Bungie, the makers of Marathon, was right in Chicago. They were down the street on the south side. I was in the north side. But they weren't that far away. So I thought, well, goodness sakes, if the Cyan guys like Bungie and I'm in Chicago and they're in Chicago, I should at least drop them an email and say, hey, we're working on the sequel to Myst. What are you working on? Because I should help you out. And so that's what I did. And I got an answer back and they asked me and Mike to come down and visit them. I think I might have visited them by myself first, come to think of it. Mike was sort of like, yeah, I don't trust any of this stuff. It's all it's all going to go away in a minute. But anyway, they were working on Myth of Fallen Lords right at that moment. And so I said, yeah, you should hire us and we'll work with you. And they said, okay. That's how easy that was.
That's amazing. I mean, it doesn't work that way now, but sometimes it does. But so I heard that you had to really persuade them that Myth needed music. And so what was your persuasive argument?
Well, it's funny because like listening to the tracks again last night, I started to put it together again, like how this thing came about. But when they asked me to come in, and basically they were just thinking that we would do sound design for them, that we would, you know, upgrade all of the sound that they were doing because we were professional. And I listened to what they had and I thought, yeah, we can do way better than this. So I had no idea like what we would do, because we were still in the middle of just starting work on Riven. So there was a lot of stuff about computer game development that I didn't know yet. But of course I acted like I did, because that's what I do. But I knew from just a quality standpoint that I would figure out how to do professional level quality stuff. And then I'd figure out what it needed to be like for a video game, at this point a computer game. And then they said, well, we're also doing these cutscenes, which was a new term for me, but we're doing these little cinematic moments that we're hiring an outside anime studio to do animated little cutscenes, and they're all short, but we really think they need more than sound design. We think they need music. And I'm looking at that. I'm like, well, of course you guys need music. How is this? What are you thinking? But anyway, I said, okay, yeah. So first it was going to be, we were going to do sound design and then music for these little cutscenes. And then I said, look, whatever music we do, do you have like a title screen? I mean, like what introduces the player to this world? We should be doing music for that too. And they're like, well, yeah, maybe. But then the next thing they came back to me with was, well, we've decided we want to do intros to each level, the scrolling text. And we thought it would be cool if somebody was somebody was reading the scrolling text while it's scrolling. And I said, well, that's not very compelling. What sort of voice do you have in mind? And they said, well, we want to hire the guy that plays the king in Braveheart.
Shoot for the moon.
Yeah. And I'm like, you mean the guy from The Prisoner? The guy from the spy TV show?
Yeah.
Patrick McGowan.
Oh, right. Sure.
Sure. Sure. And they're like, do you have any connections? Do you think you could find out if he'd be available? And I said, sure, yes, I will. I will find out. So I went to my talent people and I knew it was ridiculous. There's no way. But while they were sort of looking into whether he would be interested, I said, look, why don't we do an experiment first? There's a friend of mine in the business here in Chicago. He's a creative director of an agency. And he's got an English accent. He's from London. And he's got a really great voice. I said, why don't we have him just read one of them down and we'll see what it's like. And so I had Jeffrey Charlton Perrin come in and read, I'm pretty sure it was The Fallen Lords level, which we did as a test. And I'm looking at it and listening to it. And I'm like, well, you can't do this without music behind it. So then I wrote some music to go behind it. And I played it for Bungie with music and without music. And they were like, oh my gosh, of course it needs to have music. Can we use that same music for every one of these? And I'm like, no, you can't. It's just like, that's the dumbest thing you could possibly do. You have to have a little piece of storytelling music for each one.
Time long past, the armies of the dark came again into the lands of men. Their leaders became known as the Fallen Lords, and their terrible sorcery was without equal in the West. In 30 years, they reduced the civilized nations to carrion and ash, until the free city of Madrigal alone defied them. An army gathered there, and a desperate battle was joined against the Fallen. Heroes were born in the fire and bloodshed of the wars which followed, and their names and deeds will never be forgotten.
Of course, long story short, there was no reason not to have Jeffrey Charlton Perrin do it because he just had a perfect voice. And then we started writing a lot more music. So that's how Myth One ended up with music for the animation, music for the opening titles, and then music for all the in-game level beginning things. But there was never any music in the game itself, which was kind of unique, but that's how we ended up doing the music we did for Myth.
Well, what's so interesting about it, and especially knowing what your connection with Myst was, is that music was very, very specific too to the various levels, the ages that you would go to. And same with Riven. There wasn't music through the whole thing. It was very discreet and exactly where it needed to be, and not looping endlessly while you're trying to figure out another puzzle. And so that's what I noticed with the music for the two Myst games too, is it's not this constant wash of music.
So. Right. Yeah. And it was, I was a game fan, and I played a lot of computer games, and I played a ton of, you know, Nintendo. I don't think PlayStation was out yet. 96, 97. No, it wasn't. Anyway, the console of choice was Nintendo. And I just felt the same way Robin Miller did, who did the music for Myst and Riven, which is that music should be done as though it's a movie score. It should come in when it's needed and not be there when it's not. And so that was going to be that was my aesthetic anyway. I felt like that was a really more mature way of handling music in games. And so I looked at Myst: The Fallen Lords, and I saw, well, here's some very definite areas that music could work. And then I realized once we shipped Myst: The Fallen Lords, I thought, well, you know what? The sound engine we have is robust enough to do some very cool in-game moments where we could use it to score and expand and enhance stuff that happens in game if it's used sparingly. So Myst 2 Soulblighter had a little bit extra music in it during the game. In my head, I can't even remember where, but I know that's what we did.
Well, how did you and Mike eventually settle on the palette for these games? Because it's so distinctive with the synth strings and that amazing drumming and the piano. And so I'm just wondering what the process was to kind of get to kind of gel that sound.
Yeah, Mike and I used to have a thing where we did a lot of film scoring, like industrial films, educational films. So we used to talk about when we'd start scoring a movie, we would say, okay, who's the band? Like, who's going to be what should be the instrumentation of this movie? And like, once you narrow that down, it's sort of like, it takes you from everything is possible to like something, okay, it's going to be harmonica and ukulele. Good, we got it. That's the band. And it just sort of limits your palate and makes you work within some constraints. And I'm a big believer in coming up with some constraints if you can. So when we started with Myst, it was like, okay, this is really interesting. It's fantasy, but it's dark. You know, who's the band? And at the time we had this, I think it was the Roland JD990. I think that was the name of the synth. But it had this absolutely beautiful low string sort of cello patch on it that I really enjoyed playing. And so I think for that first little The Fallen Lords thing, I went to the keyboard and da 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 da. Was it big leaps? And I just played this. I played this little melody in the low strings, and I'm like, okay, that's nice. Mike liked it. I put some smooshy strings over the top of that, and it felt really good. And one of my other goals was like, I wanted to do music that felt like it could be a film score, or it could be has some classical underpinnings to it. And mainly because I felt like all the kids playing computer games at the time, they weren't getting much of a diet of, of orchestral classical kind of music. And I thought, well, this will at least be a different approach that might stand out a little bit better.
Thank you.
I remember bringing that to the guys at Bungie, and I'll never forget, because there was one of the programmers there named Jason Regeer, who has since gone on to fame and fortune at Blizzard. But he was a young programmer at the time. And I after I delivered this to them and I came back to visit, Jason Regeer met me in the hallway and he goes, "Marty, that cello rocks." So back in those days, like those kids making computer games, they had two ways of judging things: either it sucks or it rocks. So once I found out that it rocked, then I was good.
So. What I really love about the synth sounds is you really kind of leaned into it, because you used the synths. They sort of sound like an oboe or possibly some horns, but not really. They're synths, and you're just like, "Yep, there it is. They're synths."
Well, I mean, the thing is, back then, it's like, it was going to be a big deal to have, you know, real actors doing voices and not just guys who were around the studio, and have real recorded music and not just MIDI triggered music. So all these new steps in production value were kind of unique. But the idea of like, oh yeah, you can afford, you know, a bunch of live orchestra or live players, it's like, well, that was out of the question. That was never going to happen. So I said, yeah, we'll do everything in our studio and use all synthesizers and samplers and stuff. So that was just a given. So I guess we did lean into it. We just didn't think, well, it's not going to be anything. We can't do more than that. So let's just do the best we can with the sounds we have. And I felt really good about it. When we had a lot of really cool percussive sounds, Mike was, you know, loved working with percussion sounds and all that stuff. So we sort of cordoned off different things, tag teamed, you know, I would do a little something and Mike would come in and add to it, and vice versa. So we had a lot of fun doing that. Mike was not a big fan of the sound design portion of this. He let me handle all the nitpicky, like, here's the sound of the arrows being shot and the bows being drawn and the, you know, people walking on the ground and a bunch of that stuff. He just like, yeah, that's you, Marty. You do that stuff.
But that's the thing that makes the world really alive and makes it feel like a real place, despite, you know, the way the game looks. It sounds like a real world, which is just really cool.
Yeah, and the fun thing here is, I'm not sure how much I've talked about this before, but I was not a real-time strategy game player. I didn't play any Blizzard games. I didn't play any of the games that were supposedly in competition with Myth, the Fallen Lords. I played Myst. Before that, I was playing, you know, weird things like Crazy Taxi and Spaceship Warlock and like bizarre games. But I felt like the mature game was Myst, And I loved their aesthetic approach. So everything, you know, everything sounded real and like you could touch it and hold it. And the, you know, when the guys were in the pages of the book and they're talking to you, the video is all garbled and cool. And I just thought it was really, really nice. And so when I saw what Myth of Fallen Lords was going to be, I'm like, okay, so the camera's always going to be in your control and it's hovering above the ground, sort of, you know, 3/4 angle. Like, I didn't know that this was a thing. And then when you select people and tell them to do stuff, then they're on the ground really far away from me because I'm looking at them from the air way up here, right? And I tell a group of dwarves to go over there and do something, and then they're supposed to respond to me. Well, I wanted them to sound like they were far away from me down there responding to me. And I realized later that, like in the Blizzard games and some of these other games, the voices of the individual units were just voiceover, like right in your head. Like they didn't sound like they were on the field at all. They sounded like they were right next to you. And when I saw that, a year later, I'm like, why did they do that? These guys are really far away. And I didn't understand that that was a thing. So I didn't know we were doing anything sort of unique by making the sound effects and the voices and like explosions and everything that's happening on the field sounds like it's happening down there on the field. You know, so it's far away and over to your right, and you turn the camera and now it's behind you or to your left or whatever. I just worked on the sound designs because I wanted what I was looking at to sound like it was where it was happening. And that's what we did with everything. And I think that was somewhat unique for its time.
Well, how easy was it to do that with the engine?
I said, can you make it so it tracks, the camera tracks the position on the field? So like if it's over to the left, it'll pan a little bit to the left. And I'm like, yeah, we can do that. And I said, can you put attenuation on it so it gets louder the closer you get and softer when you get far away? And they were like, yeah, we can do that. So it was like all these, everything I asked for, they did. It wasn't necessarily what they thought it had to be, but it was like already part of the engine. And maybe if, you know, I might be misremembering, but maybe they had already sort of thought that's the way it should be. And so that's why they designed it that way. But whatever, once I understood it, it just was the right way to do it. And it didn't seem like there was many technical hurdles to get over to make it work. So that was great. Yeah.
Were there any considerations that you had with the size of the music files? Because this was still, you know, yeah, before big games and stuff. So what were some of the things, or maybe trade-offs that you had to do to get the music to sound the way you wanted, given the, you know, the space that you had?
Well, this, I think, is for people who are interested in the history of audio development in video games. This, to me, is one of the steps. Now, you know, at the same time, you've got people over at LucasArts doing their iMuse system, and like everybody was doing their own little system. And we would talk, but some of that stuff was proprietary. So I didn't know what everybody else was doing. But one of the things I saw that Bungie had started with the audio system in Myth was this called the tag system. And so you could have, for example, if you want a dwarven bottle explosion, okay, so you're going to have a, you know, with glass breaking. And they would say, here's the tag that contains dwarven bottle explosion sounds. You could do 5 different sounds and they would randomly play. Like you never knew which one would play when the dwarf threw his bottle. So I looked at that and I'm like, this is great. So part of it was you could have less content and get way more variety out of it. So like when we were doing Riven, at the same exact time we were doing Riven, ambient sound design would be 2-minute long looping files. And then, you know, there would be this beautiful stereo 2-minute long looping files with everything in it. But these were these were big files, right? So because they were 2 minutes long and they would have bird chirps and wind blowing and dogs barking and water flowing, whatever, it was all contained in this one big file. But even when it came around to the 2 minute mark, it would start looping again. And I'm like, I can hear the repetition. I don't like that. So when I looked at the bungee system for Myth of Fallen Lords, they would say you could have tiny looping sounds, but you could have as many as you want. You could have 5 or 6 looping sounds that are all different length, and they would randomly choose when they would repeat. So I could have a ambient sound of wind, and when you'd listen to it, it kept choosing different loops, so you never got a sense of it repeating. And then you could fire off random detail sounds like birds chirping, very, very short files. But if you had 5 of those and they were spaced out with silence that was randomly generated, you could get this random wind ambience and then random birds chirping around you with almost no content. It was very small amounts of content, but because the engine all played it back randomly, I remember taking walks with my wife during this period, and I was just, I wasn't talking to her, I was listening to the outside. But I would say, yeah, listen to that. That bird sound, that blue jay, it pretty much, there's like only 2 or 3 different blue jay sounds. It's just that they keep happening at random times, in random order, at random places. And I could recreate that using this engine that Bungie's giving me. So that was, believe it or not, that was really exciting. And that was the basis of the audio engine that went forward from there and is like in Halo and is in Destiny and the kind of engine that Wise has developed since then, which is basically these small items that are randomly generated and looping sounds that are randomly put together and layers of those things. It just, it's so much more like real life that it's a blast to work with. And it was while I was doing that with Myth, the Fallen Lords, that I used that same audio engine to do some looping music. It was the very first time I used that thing with some music. So there was one little section of music in the game that I could, it could be as long or as short as we needed it because I was using the same engine. But it was now, I was just using music files instead of wind and bird files. And that's when I realized, well, this engine works for everything. I could write music for this and have, you know, adaptive, randomly generated music files. So in 97, I'm like, yes, this is the future.
Well, is that something that you had ever done before? I mean, clearly it's way different from writing music for TV and music for jingles. And so it must have been just like this, I don't know, this door opens and you realize, wow, there's a lot of possibilities here, but also kind of a steep learning curve.
Yeah, there was definitely a learning curve, but the nice thing was that it wasn't like there was anybody to learn from.
Yeah.
It was like, how do other people do this? Well, not very many people are even trying this yet. So we're making it up as we go. That's the way it felt to me. So it was a lot of fun. We were exploring, I could ask questions. Can you get me to do this? Can you give it to me this way? And you know, the engineers at Bungie were like, sure, yeah, we'll give that a try. Here it is back. Now you can do this other thing. So it wasn't like today, I sort of feel bad for the, you know, 20-year-olds that are in school learning adaptive music, and there's all these tools that they have to learn, all these digital audio workstations, plus, you know, Unity and Unreal and Wise and FMod, and these things are so advanced, and they have to learn them all because they've been around for so long. In 97, there was nothing. It was like we were making it up. So there wasn't a huge learning curve because there was almost nothing to learn. Wow. So I felt. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned that you spent some time listening last night to the soundtracks. And so I'm wondering, what are some of the real standout ones for you?
Oh, well, I mean, the main theme I still like, and some of the string stuff that happened was really nice. And then the big percussion stuff that would come in. I don't even remember what tunes they are officially, but especially Myth of Fallen Lords is such a short album because there wasn't that much requirement for music. And we just decided to release the stuff we had put in the game. The opening title screen is nice. The opening movie and the closing credits are a really nice thing to listen to. I love hearing Jeffrey's voice again.
Yeah.
In the prologue. He just had such a great voice. I would love to work with him again. I still talk to him every once in a while. He's still there. So cool. But he stayed in advertising. He had his own agency. He was a creative guy and was super successful in Chicago advertising. So, yeah. But at this point, I bet you if I asked him to narrate something, he would do it in a heartbeat. So,
that's so
we should
great.
Find something to work with him on. The percussion, and then of course the piano. The funny thing about the piano is we started giving Bungie those opening maps, you know, the opening dialogue reading scrolled text reading, and we would give them one at a time to them as they gave them to us. And I started working on sound design. Mike had a bunch of music that, you know, some stuff I had started and some stuff he had started. And then one day I heard this piano piece going on and I walk in, I'm like, what's that? Like, why are you doing a piano piece? I do the piano pieces. And this is when this started. He actually said, well, you know, I was thinking, what would Marty do?
Yep.
And it was the Siege of Madrigal.
Sure.
And I was like, dang it. I wanted to do that one. So I did other versions of it later because I was so mad that he had done it, but it was just this beautiful little piano piece. And he did it. And I think I re-performed it because it was a little bit clunky, but whatever. Anyway, we gave it to Bungie. And I remember Jason Jones going, oh, Marty, I don't know, piano in Myth of Fallen Lords? I don't know if that's going to work. And I said, yeah, don't trust me. This will work. Just trust me on this. Piano, this is perfect for this. It's what people need to hear. And he's like, well, okay. So that's why I used it as an Easter egg in every game since then, because it almost got killed. It was almost taken away, and I had to fight for it.
Friday, August 8th, Otto Ferry. Our vanguard has crossed the Scamander unchallenged and remains hidden on the southern bank of the river. Their assault will begin 2 hours after midnight against Shiver's right flank, at the same time the Madrigal garrison throws open the Gate of Storms and attacks her from the front. But I won't be anywhere near Madrigal when this happens. An hour before the main attack, a small group of men and I will head in the opposite direction and strike at the enemy camp alone, hoping to divert forces and attention from the city before the real battle begins. The plan is to fight our way across a bridge and into the captured village of Comfort. From there, we'll locate the enemy camp and create as much of a diversion as possible. Every thrall that remains in the camp to deal with us is one less that our main force must hack to pieces at Madrigal.
Mike's Siege of Madrigal is, you know, lives on. Well, and I'm still mad at him for doing that. And by the way, I did a guitar piece in Myth 2, Myth Soulblighter. There's an acoustic guitar piece that I did because I was like, okay, I got to get back at Mike because he's usually the acoustic guitar guy. So I did that one.
Well, what I love about the Siege of Madrigal, the music, is that it covers the emotion of that text so well. Because Jeffrey's reading of it, I mean, the horrifying things are about to go down.
Right.
But Jeffrey's like, okay, this is our plan. And
yeah, he was very matter of fact. He never got emotional with his reading. And that's what I remember saying. It's like, look, it will be really boring if you have a person reading text that's scrolling. But if you have music that's telling a story underneath it, it'll bring all the emotion that you want. It's just a really easy way to get emotion into the story. And, you know, these 23-year-old guys at Bungie, you know, they were like, what? Emotion in the story? But that's not really true, because like Jason Jones wrote all the text. He wrote all the written stuff, the literature stuff. And he's very, very emotional. And he really is a great storyteller. So it was in there. But it was such an honor for us to be able to really bring it to life emotionally by putting music behind it.
Well, Bungie has this history of creating really tragic stories
with
the lore that you just have to like choke back tears. And I'm thinking about Halo Reach too, which is it's interesting that it started all the way back then with this kind of, you know, bleak outlook. We don't know if we're going to get through this or not.
Yeah. And there's this point, I think in Myth One, where almost in a very matter of fact way, I can't remember if it was at the end of one of the texts, after you've already, you know, the Free City of Madrigal is your last hope of humanity from the Fallen Lords. And then there's the Siege of Madrigal. And then later on, you're doing something else. You're like 1,000 miles away. And the soldier narrating just says, you know, we just received news, Madrigal has fallen. And it's like, that's all that it says. And then that's the end. And then the music ends. And it's like, you're as a player, I never got to play this game fresh, so I would know what those things felt like. But I have a feeling that was a kind of a big deal when you realize, wow, that's it. Madrigal has fallen. So
yeah, that was it fun. Speaking from experience, it was.
Yes, okay.
See, I mean, kind of, I feel like we're sort of, if I had had my podcast in 1997, we would have been doing this back then.
But, that would have been fun, like,
making up for lost time.
I would have sounded lots younger. Hi,
yeah, me
Kate.
Too. Well, what are some of the things that you learned from working on these two soundtracks that you're still using today?
Yeah, that's... I would say the main thing I learned was, and it wasn't from writing the music as much as working on, you know, being audio director for the game, is that I could have the big audio picture for the entire game, think about how the menu screens would work and how the animatics or cinematics would work, how adaptive audio would work, how dialogue would work. I directed all the actors who came in to do all the different voices for Myth and Myth 2. And they were all like friends of mine, or not friends, but lots of them were friends because we'd worked with them for so many years, but they were voiceover guys in Chicago, they were actors in Chicago who made their living doing voiceovers, but they also did, you know, they would do a lot of stage work in Chicago too. The theater world in Chicago is very robust. And they just loved coming in to do, voices for this game. And, you know, we would describe what we wanted. And Jason Jones was there describing things. And they just had a really, really good time. It was sort of over the top stuff. So I sort of cut my teeth directing actors who were doing dramatic stuff. Just like radio plays. And then of course, adaptive audio and working with engines and compression and then a final mix on a game, which wouldn't play back the same way all the time. It was always dependent on what the player did. That was a big eye-opening experience for me. But some of the things we'd already knew, which were, there are times when thematic material is really powerful. And then there are times when you're under voiceover. And if you're under voiceover, it's almost as though what you're writing is an accompaniment to the melody, which is the voiceover. So that makes life just a little bit easier. You can get away with stuff that might not stand on its own all that great because the melody is the voice, right? So, but we already knew that because we had done film scoring and commercials and stuff. So that was actually just a lot of fun for us. But then it's like, well, we did a lot of music for this and it's music that we have, we own and have control over. Why don't we release it for people to listen to? If they like it, I mean, I kind of felt like, well, some of it isn't really standalone listenable material, but maybe if it's all in one big long thing, you know, it's on its own CD, especially if you're a fan, it might bring back some emotional memories of you playing the game. Maybe you'll appreciate it. So that was sort of an experimental thing for us. It's like, can we release an original soundtrack for Myth of Fallen Lords? Will anybody be interested in it? So that was fun to see that, yeah, this is a thing. This actually might be a thing in the future. So that was, we learned so much on Myth of Fallen Lords. Just, it was the beginning point for many, many things we ended up doing.
Well, going back the other way, I mean, is there anything that you would go back and tell your 1996 self, don't do that? Don't do it that way.
That's a good question. I don't know. You know, it's like, I don't feel like we made any major errors. You know, there was so many things that we were doing that hadn't been done before, at least we hadn't done before, and it seems sort of experimental. One thing that was interesting was, and this is sort of a technical thing, I didn't trust the computer, like the volume, real-time volume changes on computers. What I heard the game engine doing in terms of real-time volume was usually sort of stair-steppy. I could hear fades going, it had little stair steps to it because frame rate would affect audio moves and stuff. So I tried to build all of that in, including just the overall volume of the WAV files, or the, at the time, I think they were AIFF files. So when I wanted something soft, like I thought, well, you know, that arrow, that bow going, you know, was a very soft, subtle sound. So if you look at the WAV file that I put in the game, you can barely see it. For those of people who work with digital audio workstations, what everybody was used to doing is normalizing every single sound effect. So you have these giant WAV files and then letting the real-time computer playback change the volume. And I just, for some reason, didn't like doing it that way. And I still don't to a certain extent. I feel like sometimes it's better to have the relative amplitude of sound files stay relative the way they are in reality when you're recording them. And that, to me, helps because the dynamic range in, like, if you listen to a piano piece, And then you listen to a 2D orchestra with the brass and everybody playing as loud as possible. The dynamic range difference is so huge. But if you normalize the piano all the way up to 100%, the piano itself suddenly sounds, it doesn't sound distorted, it just doesn't sound real. And so the piano needs to be in relationship, you know, it's mostly here on the wave file, whereas the full orchestra is here and a solo flute is here and string, a high string sustain, you might not even see that as a waveform because it's this high string sustain. This is something I learned while I was doing it. And I think to this day, I still depend on, which is I don't fall into the trap of looking at waveforms to decide whether they're right, which I swear when I play some other people's games, it's like, wow, all of this stuff is too normalized and you've lost the dynamic range. It doesn't have enough dynamic range. And it's hard to convince yourself to place, you know, if you're playing something from a scale of 0 to 10 and you say, here's the loud gunshot and it's at 10. And then here's the string sustain. Oh, I'll put that at 5. Well, that's not actually a string sustain is 0.1% of the gunshot. And it's just hard for people to put that number down to 0.05. You see what I mean? They just feel like, oh, that's not enough. I worked on those strings. I got to make them, they must sit louder. And anyway, that's not an error thing. That's just something I feel like I learned that I keep with me to this day. And if I was teaching, when I have taught some courses like at DigiPen and some other stuff, I try to convince the students that to sort of take their heads out of their audio workstations and stop looking at waveforms and keep their ears engaged. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, which is good for all of us who work in audio. Not be a slave to the wave.
yeah, there you go. Oh, I like that, slave to the wave. Is that something you just made up? I'm going to use that.
Actually, it is.
Okay, that's excellent. Right. I'm writing that down.
But I was just curious, you know, in the span of your career now, what's important to you about these soundtracks? You know, just kind of in the context of the other soundtracks that you've written or your audio work.
Well, you know, this is the advantage of having my game audio career be my second career, right? I was already in my 40s when I was working on Myth, the Fallen Lords, and Riven. So I had already, you know, succeeded in professional audio and commercials and films. We were already successful and we learned a lot. But I really enjoy the fact that I could jump into a brand new career in games and you know, learn quickly and make that a new starting point for an entirely different career that like now has been like 25 years ago. It's just insane that a quarter of a century has gone by. So I see them as like the first steps into just about everything that we ended up doing. I feel like many, many things that I learned in those first two projects, Riven and Myth, and then Soulblighter, you know, were things that I carried on with me into Halo and Destiny and stuff we're doing with Highwire right now. So it's just, I'm not embarrassed about it because I wasn't, you know, 19 trying something. I was 41 or whatever, right? I'm not embarrassed by the music. And I also know that one of the, I think, problems with synths and samples, like if you work really hard because you want to fool everybody into thinking that they're not synths and samples, sometimes, especially today, you can get close. But what I learned was like, there's something just beautiful about some of these sounds in and of themselves. So celebrate those sounds, use them, use your production to make those things sound as cool as you can. And if you want to, if you can afford it, yeah, hire some real players. And that's a whole different world. And it will bring something new out of that. But I mean, I remember people asking me about like some of the weird sort of Mellotron string samples that we would use. And I'm like, yeah, we use those because we thought they sounded cool, not because we were trying to sound like real strings. Like, we all grew up listening to, you know, Moody Blues and the Beatles and other people in the 60s using Mellotron. And we just thought, we didn't think, well, those are real strings. We thought, wow, what is that? It sounds cool. You know, the flutes in Strawberry Fields. I mean, I never thought, oh, they got real flute players. I thought, what is that? It's fluty, but it's not. It's something just cool and otherworldly. So there are times when you should just celebrate the sounds you have, but you still have to use them musically. So when I hear people just using straight up samples and there's no shape to them and they don't do any processing or they don't play them musically. They sound mechanical, they sound harsh. I think that's a mistake. So when people say, oh, well, this doesn't sound very good because I'm just using a synth, I'm like, no, that doesn't work. You should make everything you're working with sound good. There's nothing about using a single synthesizer that you shouldn't be able to make great sounding professional music on. It's just, it's on a synth. So what? That's great. Make it sound great. So there was another long answer to a simple question.
That's okay. That's what makes it fun to talk. So
yeah, that's me.
But boy, I'm really grateful for you to put these on Bandcamp because we didn't get the original CDs. And so it's been great experience listening to them again. And
well, I'm glad. And what happened was, I don't even remember exactly what it was. I think somebody asked me, hey, can you send me one of these pieces? Because this is the only place I can find it. I looked and it was like on Amazon. You could buy the CD on Amazon for, you know, hundreds of dollars or something ridiculous. And I thought, well, that shouldn't be an impediment. Like this, I'm just going to like, if you want to download all the as high res as we ever did, 1644.1, here it is. And you can listen to it for free because you should be able to listen to it for free. So go to Bandcamp and listen to it. And if you like it, download it. It's a nominal fee. I'm basically just like, I don't want to take advantage of Bandcamp and not have something be paid for, but it's so cheap. If you want it, you can have it. And why not? I mean, I think people should. So
yeah, that's awesome. Well, I know you're working on something else, so I'm pretty sure we'll be talking again at some point. But Marty,
just... that I hope you do, because I'm really excited about the new thing we're working on, and apparently it's relatively controversial. So I would love to talk to you about our approach and my approach musically and from an audio standpoint and everything else. But yeah, we're working on 6 Days in Fallujah, which has already been announced, and by the time this airs, there'll probably be some new stuff out there for people to talk about. So we'll see what happens.
Fantastic. Well, it's been great to catch up, and thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Kate. Appreciate it.
Monday, May 4th, Seven Gates. The fallen lords are dead, and the dark has fled the land. Now we return to the difficult task of rebuilding. It will take many years to restore our cities and recover our farmlands, and this time we will remain vigilant. I have chosen to follow the Emperor and his Heron Guard back to Myrfenri. There is nothing left for me in Strand, the place of my birth. I have become fast friends with Nine Skull Crocodile, the man who has healed the many wounds I received during the assault on Tharsis. He is ancient, even by Heron standard. And speaking with him has given me some insight into what has happened to our world. There are laws that govern the workings of the universe that have remained immutable for countless eons. According to these laws, the forces of light and dark hold dominion over the world successively, the land belonging in turn to men or to monsters. Each cycle would be presaged by the appearance of a great comet, foretelling the rise of savior or destroyer. Each golden age would give way to one of darkness, when foul things would stir beneath the earth and evil spirits would plague the land. In turn, each dark age would fall to one of light. The evil would pass from the land, just as the comet from the sky. The saviors of each golden age were men who had risen to face the dark and never turned away. They were men of unflinching heroism who would not rest until they had loosened the bloodless grip of wicked things which had dominated their lands. Many of these heroes were doomed to return in the following age as fallen lords. destroying all they had fought so hard to preserve. Although the hero of every age of light is different, every dark age is ushered in by the same beast, a transient divinity that seeks only conflict, the Leveler. And so Tiresias returned as Mohagen to end the Age of Reason, and Connaught, the great hero of the Wind Age, returned as Balor to lay waste to the greatest empire the world had ever known. The Leveler was never killed. He was immobilized by sorcery, beheaded, and burned at the stake in the Second Era. 1,000 years later, he was drawn and quartered on the plains before Ilium, the tireless horses dragging the pieces of his lifeless body to the four corners of the world. Again, in the Fourth Era, his body was destroyed by fire, his ashes mixed with salt and buried under the mountains of Kor. Balor, Mohagen, and all those before them wore the mantle of the Leveler. When I stated that Balor was vanquished but 60 years ago, Nineskull nodded thoughtfully. Soulblighter was not the Leveler. He may have been if he had survived into the next millennium, but in his attempt to force the cycle, he perished, and almost certainly will suffer at the hands of those who set it in motion. It is even conceivable that because of his actions, the cycle has been broken. But we cannot be sure. At least, not for another 940 years. Nineskull chuckled, saying that with a little luck, he may still be around to see. He told me about Olmiothemli, describing it with words that seemed out of place coming from such a grizzled warrior. He spoke of its many spired palaces and monuments, and the grand bazaar during each year's harvest. When I told him that I wished I could have seen the city at the height of its power, he said I might see it in my lifetime. Then he told me that next year the Herengard will be reinstating the Septannual Tournament to fill out their ranks. Men of bravery and warriors of renown from every corner of the Empire will gather to compete for the honor of joining them. I will be there.